Today on Life and Faith.
Being a rabbi, I always kid around that I'm a Hebrew school dropout. The rabbi and I only agreed upon one thing in Hebrew school. He didn't want me there and I didn't want to be there.
We're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
This is Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Tell me your sins, my son.
Well, I should mention that I'm Jewish.
Well, that's no sin.
Oh, good. Anyway, I wanted to talk to you about Dr. Whatley. I have a suspicion that he's converted to Judaism purely for the jokes.
And this offends you as a Jewish person?
No, it offends me as a comedian.
If you were alive in the 90s, you'll instantly recognize that as a scene from Seinfeld. And it's thanks to shows like this and like Friends and Will and Grace that a certain brand of New York Jewishness became a very familiar part of pop culture. Even if you've never met a Jewish person from New York, you feel like you know what it means. You know some of the characteristic mannerisms and customs, and especially the humor of that particular community.
So when we got to meet a New York rabbi recently, a real live one, this was something we had to ask him about. What's it like to be part of a minority group that punches well above its weight culturally, that everyone thinks they know about? Actually, Simon and I asked Rabbi Bob Kaplan a lot of things. He's done so many things that it was hard to know where to start.
It was. Rabbi Bob is involved in a whole lot of interfaith stuff. He's worked with police and educators. He's spoken at the White House. After 9/11, he served as a grief counsellor at a Ground Zero respite centre. And he gets called in to do mediation and conflict resolution in some of the most tense situations around the world. All of this from a guy who didn't even mean to become a rabbi in the first place.
We began, though, with New York and what he loves about it.
New York is an exceptional place. First of all, I was born there. So you have that natural connectivity being born there. And I'm from Brooklyn. The Brooklyn I'm from was a very different place. It was much more, I guess, less gentrified, a little bit more gritty, place that people went to only if they couldn't live someplace else. So I really liked that. However, I grew up in a public housing project, what we call the projects. And the diversity of Brooklyn is something that I love as well, that it isn't all just one kind of folk. It's all different kinds of people sort of making it through and figuring out how they're going to navigate all this stuff that allows us to get to where we are.
I want to ask you about being a Jewish rabbi in New York, because New York Jewish is kind of it's a subculture that we all think we know quite well. It's mm-hmm. very prominent in kind of popular culture. I'm wondering what it's like to be part of, you know, what is a cultural minority but has this very distinct identity in a city.
Again, that's an interesting question because New York, first of all, New York has the largest Jewish population of any city in the world, a little over a million. It's actually 1.1. And you're right, the culture that comes out of Jewish New York, you know, is, we always wonder sometimes when people watch Seinfeld, you know,
I mean, yep.
Do they get it? Because these are in jokes, you know, this is like family jokes. And it's like, however, that's on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. If you go into Brooklyn today, you're going to find other kinds of Jews. Matter of fact, the demography of Jewish New York is changing radically. There is an explosion of Orthodox Jews, ultra-Orthodox Jews, just because of a birth rate. So what was once a relatively small section of the Jewish community, the very religious section, is now somewhere around 40 to 50% of the community. So it's not the Seinfeld Jews. It's not the Jews that get popularized through folks like Woody Allen. Those folks are what I grew up with and what I expected. However, we're diverse. We're incredibly diverse, and we're becoming more and more diverse as things permute within this incredible city.
You say you grew up very secular, but you no longer that. So how did what was the story there? How did you?
Well, that's that in itself has been a pretty dynamic pathway. My grandfather was a pretty religious guy. None of the children decided to go in that direction. It's a very typical story. I grew up Jewish by name, food, flavor, you know, connectivity, and I lived in a very large Jewish area, even though it was pretty diverse. So all anyone who lived there, whether they were Italian or Irish or African American or Puerto Rican, they were all Jewish anyway. So we all sort of shared cultures. However, when you get to that age when you start looking around and figuring out who you are, if you don't have a spiritual basis, if you don't have a foundation that you can really build upon, you got to go looking for one. Now, being a rabbi, I always kid around that I'm a Hebrew school dropout. the rabbi and I only agreed upon one thing in Hebrew school. He didn't want me there, and I didn't want to be there. So I took my bar mitzvah, you know, the Hebrew was all transliterated, B-A-W-R-U-C-H, Baruch. However, I was connected, so I took Hebrew as a language in high school and in college. I was part of a Jewish youth group, but not, it wasn't feeding the spiritual side of me. So I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s, met someone in the world of meditation and the New Age world, and spent a number of years very closely connected to, I would say, a New Age community, a guru world, and living and actually managing an ashram up in the certain part of New England. And that was my deep, deep spiritual dive for that period of my life. It didn't last. It just wasn't who I was. And somewhere along the road, again, you know, you run into stuff, and there's always somebody out there connecting you to something. Because of a whole set of circumstances, a cousin of mine was getting divorced. There is a formal Jewish divorce, a religious divorce called a get, and he wanted to go, he was secular, I was secular. He wanted us to go see a rabbi. I wasn't particularly into it because never had a great experience with rabbis. However, he prevailed, and I met this person, really dynamic person, who was, like me, an ex-hippie, who had been on other spiritual journeys in his life. And he brought me in slow. Matter of fact, interesting story. One of his teachers once asked me how I wanted to proceed in my learning. And I gave him the whole story. I thought I'd freak him out, told him the whole hippie story and the ashram story, and thought it would freak him out. And the rabbi turned to me and said, "You know something, I'm glad that you want to go slow, because if you jump into a pool and you don't know how to swim, you will drown." And I always thought that was wise advice. So slowly, slowly, I started taking on more of a Jewish spiritual path, an Orthodox one, a very deep one. It was a very, very deep level of connectivity. And one of the rabbis there thought I'd be a good rabbi. I thought he was out of his mind. However, again, he prevailed. And it took me a while to get used to it. So it's been a very, very interesting journey.
So you really didn't expect to be a rabbi. How old were you when you...
I was in my 30s.
Yeah, there you
go. It was not on the work plan by any stretch of the imagination.
You've spoken about how diverse New York is, and it definitely has that reputation and that image worldwide as being a very multicultural, very tolerant place. Does it live up to that image? And if so, why do you think it works so well?
Well, it lives that image. However, if you live in one place, you don't necessarily know how diverse it is in other places. If you live in Manhattan, certain parts of Manhattan, you may see all these folks on the trains and on the buses and walking on the street, but you don't know their neighborhoods because, you know, it's a pretty big place. Actually, when I took a tour around Sydney, it's very similar here. You have ethnic and faith-based enclaves, and people are not always necessarily navigating in and out of them. So that's one of the things that we have really tried to do, is create points of entry for different folks to know the other in not just like a kumbaya-ish way, I mean, because that's nice, but it doesn't really get you to the next stage, is how do they share society? How do they solve problems together? How do they look at healthcare? How do they look at education? How do they look at law enforcement? So we have actually, over the years, and in the work that I've been doing in shared society work in New York, we have incubated many different community-based coalitions that have brought together diverse populations in a problem-solving process. We have formal fellowships for teens, as I mentioned before, up-and-coming not-for-profit, faith-based, governmental, and communal leaders. Then we had one that kicked off a couple of years ago, which I'm really very excited about, called Women in Faith. It's not necessarily for faith leaders. It's for women where faith is a very important motivation. But they're lawyers, they're doctors, they're teachers, they're all different kinds of stuff, and it's intergenerational. So you can have folks in that are retired or in college. And that's another divide that we are really first beginning to learn to navigate, is the intergenerational divide.
In the wake of the 9/11 attacks, you were involved in grief counseling with relief workers working for the American Red Cross. I imagine that was incredibly intense work.
Yep, it was pretty intense. And things that we were not quite all prepared for. So one of the beauties of what happened at the end of the day is other counselors would sort of counsel you to figure out whether you made it through the day well enough. And also you're interfacing with people very unlike yourself. I was very unsure. You know, here I am. I grew up a relatively secular, tough Jewish kid in Brooklyn. So and a lot of my friends are from different worlds, but here I was interfacing with hard hats and construction workers and all different kinds of other folks. It was challenging. However, my job was to be there for them and allow them to flow out and to get rid of some of that pain that they were carrying around with you. The problem is that we are the receptacle of that pain and we have to learn how to deal with ourselves. So that was a pretty intense experience.
Are there ways that you saw individuals and or the city itself change as a result of 9/11?
So, yeah. A lot of the stuff that we learned prior to 9/11 and the work that we did really came into play. The relationships came into play. We helped the police connect up to Muslim populations that we had done work with around healthcare. So we had that connectivity, so we were able to, allow folks to be able to do that. Listen, there was a lot of good feelings that came out that was that lasted a short amount of time. But we also saw the ability to really connect up and know how to work with each other. The problem is sometimes that when it gets back to normalcy, and normalcy comes in any crisis has a life cycle to it. So the normalcy comes back somewhere along the road. You begin to fall back into some of your old patterns. And the trick is not to fall back into every old pattern. So I think we moved the world a little bit forward. We had hoped we moved it a little bit more forward than we did. However, I think we moved a little forward.
Well, that's an achievement.
Yeah.
You do a lot of different things, this grief counseling. You do a lot of community organizing. You teach. You've worked with the police in education and health. You wear a lot of hats. I'm wondering if you can comment on kind of the busyness of our culture and how you manage to do so many different things.
You get tired real fast. Well, that is something that I am really trying to work on, tell you the truth. We have this notion in our heads that we got to do this, we got to do that, we got to do this, we got to do that. I am beginning to work, God should give me strength to do this, on understanding where my borders are and what is healthy for me and what is not healthy for me. What I may have done in the past where I didn't pay enough attention to my family because I was paying attention to other things. And what does it mean to teach others to do it and to give it up or to give it over? I'm in that stage in life where I'm actually talking about the R word, retirement. And what does that mean? It means leaving a job that I might be doing now and a couple of years from now. However, at the same time, training others about how I think and the methodologies that I use, at the same time allowing it and the work to really reflect them and who they are and the world that they live in. It can't just be how Bob sees it. It has to be how we all see it. So when I interface with some younger staff, it's an intergenerational learning process. Somebody gave me this great word that I've been using a lot lately. It's called saging. You don't just age, you sage. You begin to give over some of the stuff that's inside of you, but it's at the same time, you begin to grow tremendously. You grow because you know where your borders are. And sometimes those borders are told to you expressly by little aches and pains that come along with getting a little bit older. And knowing that you have gray in your beard rather than you looking as you did, or knowing who you are in the context of the world around you. It's all about the same thing we were talking about before, is developing a deeper sense of self-consciousness or self-awareness and allowing that to be a stronger guide in your life. I'm not quite sure I was as self-aware when I was younger. And just doing all that stuff all at the same time. But you know, it's just the way it was.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. Natasha and I are speaking with Rabbi Bob Kaplan. For decades in New York, but also in places like Northern Ireland and Israel, he's been trying to work out how to get people who don't see eye to eye on things to work together, to build real community, and to find practical solutions to what look like intractable problems. Now, I'm sometimes a bit skeptical about the interfaith thing. I think the caricature, at least, is of a kind of wishy-washy idea of let's all get along and paper over our actual differences. What Rabbi Bob does is not that.
Well, you got to be able to have courageous conversations. You got to be able to ask questions that are going to cause a little discomfort. However, I'm not sure that's where you start.
No.
You start by finding ways of looking through the other's lens. I'll tell you a very interesting story that happened to me. I have a very dear friend back in New York. His name is Mohammed Razvi, Mo. And Mo and I do a lot of traveling together. We've done a lot of teaching together. We do a lot of stuff in New York together. Obviously, Mo is Muslim. He's from Brooklyn. He's Pakistani. We have been working together since 9/11, literally, couple of days afterwards, and his community is cheek and jowl with his Orthodox Muslim community is cheek and jowl with a very large Orthodox Jewish community. Well, we were invited by the British Foreign Ministry to some training and teaching in Great Britain, and they took us to Leeds, and we went to go meet his Ayatollah. He's Shia, and you know, sitting in that room with Ayatollah, he's looking at me, I'm looking at him. We're both a little uncomfortable with each other. And then the Ayatollah's young son walks in. He had several piercings and a couple of tattoos, and he didn't exactly look like the Ayatollah
didn't
type.
Fit the image.
He was as we call it, he wasn't exactly following the pathway. His father looked a little bit discomforted, but he obviously loved his son. He talked to his son. And then when the son left, I leaned into the Ayatollah and I said, "So you got one too?" And he just comes back at me. He goes, "How do you deal with it?" The humanity that happened at that moment, yeah, of understanding that he has his traditional trajectory and expectations, I have mine. They're really different in many, many ways. And they can be conflictual. They can actually cause really bad conflict. But we were just being two fathers at that point, dealing with this interface of our faith, our expectations, our parenting, who we were and what we were all about, and the Western world that we have encountered and that we have to navigate. And the conversation that happened at that moment was just wonderful. But all that stuff that could have led us to just continue sitting there being stale with each other or stiff with each other sort of dissipated in a moment. And that's sort of the way that we approach interfaith work in New York. But we don't just call it interfaith work. We really call it a shared society. Because a person's faith is just one aspect, albeit in most, many people, and some people it means almost nothing. In many people it means everything. However, it's part of the lens that we look at the world through. So we want to be holistic in the way that we approach a person. And what their main issue at that point that may bring them together with others may be healthcare, or it may be law enforcement, or it may be, we always kid around, it could be underwater basket weaving. It really doesn't make a difference what it is, as long as we can find that point of confluence and for them to be able to effectively begin to solve problems together and develop a human and divine connection with one another, well, then we've gotten to the place where we can move it forward.
You mentioned Western secular context. I wonder what you think most people in that context might not get about religion and religious people. What are they missing there?
That's a tough question. I'm not going to use the word missing. I'm going to use the word misunderstand.
Yeah.
The fact that people of faith are doing what they need to do anyway. They are navigating the world strictly through that lens and moving it forward through that lens. And once you begin to explain that to folks, that this is a lens, this is a pathway, this is a point of connectivity, it sort of eases it up a little bit. However, it takes the old world of two to tango. You got to do that to the faith person as well. Here's the essence, and this is really the key to the kingdom, so to speak. We must honor the dignity of the narrative of the other. We have to consistently give the other dignity. And once we violate the dignity of the other, what comes out of that process is an inability to communicate. So the person who is of faith will be equally prone to violating the dignity of the other through the lens of their faith as the person who is secular. Our job is to recognize that we do that, know where those pitfalls are, know where those lines are, and not only not dishonor or violate the dignity of the other, learn how to repair it at the same time. And while we're doing the repairing, learn how we can likewise honor the dignity to bring that person into our circle. It's a hard road, and it's one that has really been illuminated to me. There's a book that I ran into a couple of years ago written by Professor Donna Hicks at Harvard University called Dignity, and followed up by a book called Leadership Through Dignity that has really begun to explain to me in language that I was searching for a really long time, of how to do some of that fixing and how to be self-aware when we are violating the dignity of the other, and then even more self-aware as we begin to repair those violations that we've caused along the road. And since this is a program of faith, you got to do it with a notion of how is my faith going to really exhibit through me, and how am I going to continue to grow as part of the wholeness of the divine? And when I'm encountering someone, even if I vehemently disagree with them, listen, I'm not talking about people who want to kill you. There are points where you got to defend yourself. It's just real plain and simple, not being Pollyannish. But that most of the interface with people, this arguments that's going on in society, doesn't even reach that level. It is your politics are bad, or the food you eat is bad, or your faith is bad.
The sporting team you support.
How do you get to that place of understanding that you're encountering the divine when you're encountering another human being?
You've trained in mediation and conflict resolution and bridge building around the world. You've done that in Northern Ireland. You've done it in Israel. What have you discovered about these conflict hotspots, this sort of political and also ethnic divisions that might not be obvious to people from the outside?
Well, it's a great question again. I'll illustrate it by a story. When I was in Northern Ireland, in Belfast, right after the Accords was signed, I've been telling the story a lot lately, we were sitting around one night drinking a bit of Guinness, and you get a little
as you do
as you get a little bit more comfortable. It is my understanding that Guinness does not travel well.
It doesn't.
It tastes best in Ireland.
It doesn't even travel well across to London.
Well,
you have to do it.
You have to drink it in Ireland, and Northern Ireland is still part of Ireland.
Yep, so yeah, we'll give you that.
Sitting around with all the mediators, and I leaned into one of them and I said, "So tell me, how do you know who to hate?" I said, in America, and this is, I say this with difficulty, we sort of have a color code, you know? And he smiled and said, and I'll do this in my best Northern Ireland dialect.
I'm looking forward to this.
He goes, "Well, you have to understand, Bob. If you're a Catholic, you say H. And if you're a Protestant, you say H. So if I'm a Catholic walking around the block and I hear someone say H, I've got to kill him." And I looked at him, his name is Alistair. I said, "Alistair, that's simple." He goes, "Well, it's a little bit more complicated, but that's about it." And what he was really telling me is that we can become incredibly nuanced in what is the art of hating. It can be how you pronounce a letter as opposed to a color code or a faith or, you know, a socioeconomic background. It doesn't have to be as complex as all that. All that being said, how you pronounce that letter is your faith, is your color code, is your socioeconomics, is your education, is hundreds of years of history. And it all plays out in that way. And that was an epiphanal moment for me to understand that this work that we're doing is incredibly complex. We cannot simplify it, whether it's dealing with Israelis and Palestinians or it's dealing with Muslims and Jews. And by the way, even all the Muslims and Jews get along perfectly in the world. By the way, it isn't all solved. So it's really a human problem. But it's complex, and we have to learn to appreciate that complexity. And we have to begin to understand that complexity when we're in that solving process. That means we have to be open, allowing a flow of information into us. And a short story of a Zen Buddhist story is that we have to pour out some of the tea from our cup to allow in space for the other to be there as well, rather than having the full cup when we encounter the other.
I want to ask you about Israel-Palestine. It's perhaps the world's most intractable conflict. What's your sense of what's going on the ground there? And are there things where you've seen signs of something different to what we sometimes expect to see that would give you hope?
First of all, I always have hope. Second of all, I don't think it's the world's most intractable conflict. I think that it's one that we focus on a lot for lots of complex reasons. I'll tell you one thing I heard from a journalist. I said to him, "How come there's so many journalists here?" He says, "Well, difference is when there's a war going on here, I can sleep in the King David Hotel at night, travel 5 miles into the war zone, get incredible footage, not worry about any problems with electricity or broadcasting, come back to the King David Hotel, write my stuff up, and send it out." He says, "It's a lot easier to do." That was a remarkable epiphany as well. However, there are folks doing amazing stuff day by day. There are folks that said, you know, we need to have our hospitals culturally competent. That means that we need to deal with language and culture when people are sick. So they've created a system of cultural competency so that language and culture and faith is respected and honored when one is in getting one sick or needs to be able to be healed. That is now slipping into the police department. So friends of mine in Israel that have been doing incredible work around healthcare and cultural competency is now doing cultural competency with the police. I see this as a very positive thing because when politicians who are not usually the best at solving problems like that. They may be good at solving other problems sometimes. Finally get their act together. There's a whole lot of people doing a whole lot of good stuff on a very localized basis, learning to share resources and share life on a daily basis. So there will be very fertile ground for the stuff to grow in. We have to have patience on this thing, and patience sometimes is something we don't understand or appreciate, but we do have to have patience. And this is, by the way, everywhere I go. This is not just in the Middle East. This is the black Jewish thing, or the white Jewish thing, or the Protestant Catholic thing, or, you know, I know that South Africa is going through a whole bunch of stuff right now. Everywhere where there is a seemingly intractable problem, I think that we have the ability to solve it.
We asked Rabbi Bob to give us an example of how mediation works on the ground. He told us this story about a colleague of his bringing very different groups to the same table in Jerusalem.
My partner there, his name is Haggai Agman Sneer. He runs the Jerusalem Intercultural Center. We have a formal relationship called the New York Jerusalem Experts Exchange, where we look at exchanging best practices and building diverse societies or encountering diverse societies. Actually was able to bring together, when they had the first gay pride parade or connection in Jerusalem, not Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv, from what I understand, is the most gay-friendly city in the world. He was able to, through a coalition-building process and a lot of stuff that we mutually learned from each other, bring to the table the police, the government, the Open Center, which represented the LGBTQ community, and the ultra-Orthodox. And what he did is he listened to each one of them. And here's the key. He listened to each one of them to hear what their issues were. The gay community wanted a march. The ultra-Orthodox community didn't want them to march, particularly in the center of town. The police didn't want a riot. I mean, that was their main concern. The city didn't want a riot. That was their main concern. So he got them to agree the first year that there would be a limited march, and that they would march in a certain area or gather in a certain area that wouldn't be in the face of the ultra-Orthodox community. And the ultra-Orthodox community said, we're still going to be against it. However, we're not going to necessarily do it there. And eventually, it started working. Eventually, people were in a problem-solving mode. And when they now have the gay pride parade in Jerusalem, it's not quite as disruptive. And I say that with a tremendous amount of joy. It's not quite as disruptive and destructive. Now, there have been instances where people have been, because of extremism on both sides, there was some people killed, and there have been horrible things that have happened. However, it could have been a lot worse. Could have been a lot worse. And you have to celebrate, by the way, the victories. You really have to celebrate the victories, even if the victories did not take care of everything.
Small wins.
Yeah.
In terms of peacemaking, do you think there are things that religious people specifically have to offer in that process?
Yes. I think that there are things that people of faith have to offer. First of all, they have to understand their faith. That's the first important step. They have to understand their faith and the impact it has on them. They have to truly assimilate it into their soul and their actions. And that's a process that we need to be able to do. And once they do that, they can be better at being part of the peacemaking process. I think, unfortunately, like many people, we don't tend to become self-aware. One of, again, a great teacher that I ran into, a great rabbi that had been in the concentration camps, survived, and was a truly holy soul. It's the only way to describe him. And I was talking to him about connecting up to another human being where there was some conflict going on in his family. And it's a long story, and I won't go into all the details. However, when I went to go see him, he said this. He said, the first thing you need to do is learn to love this human being. And the second thing you need to do, you need to embrace, fully embrace that human being for who and what he is. When you take care of these two things, then you can begin to teach him. Until you take care of these things, ain't gonna go nowhere. That was a very powerful statement. So yes, I think people of faith have incredible things to bring to the table. But first, they got to understand what those things are.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart.
And me, Natasha Moore.
And today's conversation was with Rabbi Bob Kaplan, who was in Sydney with the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies.
If you were listening to this episode and thinking, oh, this person I know would love this conversation, do us a favour and share it with them. We'd love for you to do the other things as well that help us get the podcast out. Leave us a rating or a review, you know the drill, and hit subscribe on your podcast app so you don't miss any episodes.
Coming up next week.
The Bible is like this beautiful mirror that at the same time is a two-way glass. So it allows me to see myself on the one hand and also see through it to the world in a way that is distinctive and challenging on the other.